Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, a podcast series for owners and key stakeholders in privately held companies and the professionals that surround them. My name is Josh Pottinger, and together with Jason Georgianis, we run ATX Wealth Partners here at UBS. Jason and I have been teamed up now for over 20 years, and each of us has over 25 years of experience in the financial services industry. Our goal is to bring real-world perspectives to help you prepare yourself, your family, and your business for the day that you decide to monetize some or all of your ownership position in the company. Throughout this series, we will provide our own thoughts as well as interview key people along the way. Feel free to email us at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And with that, let's go ahead and get started. Hello, friends. Josh Pottinger here, and I'm excited to announce our 21st episode in Lightning in a Bottle, a podcast series that's really focused on helping those owners and key stakeholders out there of those privately held companies get themselves ready for some sort of monetization event. Maybe they want to sell some, maybe they want to sell all, you know, who knows. But anyway, there's a lot to it, and we're excited here. So number 21, I've got a couple of guests with me today that I'm excited to announce. I've got Eric Renner and Grace Augusti, and they're with Alvarez and Marsal. Now, Alvarez, for those of you that may not be familiar with A&M, which is kind of what we all reference them as, Tony Alvarez and Brian Marsal, they joined forces back in 1987, and they've gone from 3 employees to 8,500 employees in 80 offices in 39 different countries. And I think they're one of the largest privately held global professional services firms out there right now. And they're a national restructuring firm and just helping companies improve their operational and financial performance. So that's a little bit about A&M. Let me introduce our guests. We've got Grace Augusti. She's a senior director with A&M in the Transaction Advisory Group in New York, and she brings more than 5 years of transaction experience and has provided buy-side and sell-side financial due diligence services to private equity and corporate clients on transactions ranging anywhere from $10 million to more than $5 billion. Grace, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. It shows how outdated my bio is on that, because I'm up to 10 years of experience in M&A.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Okay, you need to update that. I saw when I was saying it, you were like, I sounded like something was wrong. So we also have Eric Renner. He's a managing director with A&M's Global Transaction Tax Practice in Dallas. So he was coming in hot this morning off of I-35. One of my least favorite stretches of roads in the entire world. And he has extensive experience working with financial and strategic buyers and sellers in the mergers and acquisition space. So we're gonna talk today about something super exciting, something called the quality of earnings, QOE. Now, for those of you that might be listening, most of you might be familiar with the QOE. And for those of you that are not, when someone that is running a business that is preparing for some sort of transaction, whoever is on the other side of the table, the buyer of the company or the investor of the company, they're going to want to make sure that what you're telling them is, in fact, the truth and accurate. And because they're spending a lot of money, they might be dropping $30 million, $50 million, $100 million, $1 billion on your company. And those valuations are predicated on the financials and the expectations and growth rates and other variables in there. But the quality of earnings process is a very critical piece. And quite frankly, from what I've gathered over the years, a weak point for a lot of business owners that are getting ready for the transaction. They don't have everything prepared. And that's where things break down. And there's actually a very small percentage of the businesses that go to market that actually have a successful process. And it's usually because of the due diligence process, things break down. So enough of me rambling on here. I want to get you guys involved. That's why we've got you here. So what is due diligence and why is it important to the owners?
Well, first of all, Josh, thanks for having us. We're so happy to be here with you today. So what is due diligence? When it's basically the acquirer's opportunity to do a comprehensive review of your company, right? And the goal of the whole process is to identify and evaluate the business drivers and risks and opportunities that are involved in buying your company. And really, it's a very critical step in any transaction, because this is when the buyer is gathering all the information that they need to make an informed decision, right? Every transaction's different, and due diligence really should be tailored to meet the needs of the buyer and the target company that they're looking at. And buyers really want to know what the deal issues are and what are the value drivers so that they can maximize the value of every transaction and minimize any post-transaction surprises. So that, in a nutshell, is what due diligence is. Now, it takes the form of many different work streams, right? I do financial due diligence. Eric does tax due diligence, but there's also a number of other work streams. There's legal that gets involved. It can also include human capital, IT, ESG, which is environmental, social, and governance, commercial, operational, insurance diligence. So it can really run the gamut in terms of the different work streams that are involved throughout this process.
So you mentioned you do the financial?
Yes.
And then Eric handles the tax
sure.
part.
Yeah.
So what, maybe quick.
Yeah, maybe I'll take that one. So, you know, Grace and her team are going to do things like look at the quality of earnings, right? So the idea is let's find what's normalized run rate earnings, taking out all the one-time items to understand if bankers are coming to you and saying businesses in your industry trade at 7 or 8 times EBITDA, we need to know what EBITDA is, right? Like, so everything you can get into that is going to increase your overall valuation.
What's an example of something that you would add in,
well,
or take out?
So, you know, in we'll see, like, in closely held businesses, you know, for instance, sometimes there'll be some commingling of personal assets and things.
No.
And so there's, yeah, right. And
no.
So understanding kind of some of those items and what, you know, what maybe was the right compensation for the founders, that maybe they're going to stick around in the future, or maybe they're going to exit and they're going to replace that person with a new CFO, a new CEO, that kind of thing. And what's the right number to use? So that's kind of the idea of, well, a lot of what the quality of earnings analysis is. Piggybacking off of that, right? Like, there's other kind of blocking and tackling of, like, are there debt-like items? So one-time costs, CapEx costs that you know are coming that aren't in your normalized earnings, but that as a buyer you need to be aware of, because that needs to factor into your price and how much you're willing to pay and how much of that's going into the business versus going to the sellers, as well as, like, net working capital and things that just need to be negotiated to sort of close out the process. Where the tax side of it comes in is, one, understanding what is sort of the tax profile of the company. Is it a corporation subject to corporate level tax? Is it a flow through, like an S corp, a partnership, an LLC, whatever, where there's only one level of tax historically, mm-hmm. at least at the income tax level? And then there's obviously always the non-income taxes, like sales and use and property and payroll and things. But understanding the tax position of the company is one dynamic. The other is, what are the risks that have been taken that somebody as a buyer needs to be aware of, in terms of that you're going to be stepping into that risk, or it needs to be cleaned up and it needs to be negotiated as part of the closing purchase price? Mm-hmm. Is it a debt-like item, so to speak? Mm-hmm. Those are the main kind of components of the sort of tax diligence. Now, moving past tax diligence, you get into the tax structuring side, which is kind of another element altogether. And that's understanding, what does the seller prefer in terms of the transaction structure, selling stock or assets, and what does the buyer prefer, and what are the sort of benefits and costs of either option?
So I guess if you have a different tax structure from the acquiring company and the acquiree, I guess, you know,
general,
you get a C corp buying a partnership, or, I mean,
sellers are almost always going to prefer to sell the equity of the business. They want to sell, what, regardless of if it's the stock of a corporation that's treated as a C corporation.
Are you speaking to like between a stock and asset sale?
Right.
Yeah. And the tax implications around.
And it's important when you talk about the, you know, big picture stock versus asset sale. The concepts in tax are a little bit different than they are for legal purposes. A lot of times, Grace and I will hear it's a stock deal, and we later come to find out, well, they mean they're selling all the equity of a LLC, which is taxed as a partnership. So for tax purposes, a flow-through sale, with the exception of an S-corp, is treated more like an asset disposition. But all that being said, yeah, you want to understand what's sort of better for either party. Like I said, a seller is almost always going to prefer to sell the equity, because they walk away from the risks at that point. If they dispose of the legal entity, mm-hmm. as well as everything in it, then they don't, it's a lot harder for them to retain the risks that would have existed prior to their mm-hmm. to their sale. Now, on the other side, the buyers almost always prefer, right, the opposite. They want to buy just the assets of the business, and they don't want to buy the legal entities, because they don't want to step into all that extra risk. And that's the concept of diligence, is understanding how much inherent risk could there be, known or unknown, you know, that might be there. And so then I'm recommending to my client, usually on the buy side, well, what do you prefer? Do you prefer to, you know, is it okay to buy their legal entity, which they want to sell to you, or do you want to suggest something different? The other side of the structuring question is around what tax basis or tax attributes carry over. Like, so are you getting NOLs or tax credits that are coming over that would have been created prior to the transaction?
The acronym, okay.
Yeah, NOLs are net operating losses. Yep. So there's a loss carry forwards that are—
No acronyms allowed, okay.
Understood. That are available to, you know, for the buyer to use to offset future taxable income. So the buyer's always trying to understand how do they maximize the amount of value they can get in tax shield. And if they buy stock, yeah, the buyer's going to get carryover tax basis and it's going to get, you know, maybe some attributes. If they buy assets, they get to step up to fair market value all of the stuff they just bought, and then they get to depreciate and amortize it, which is usually a lot better than taking carryover basis. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the rub of why buyers frequently want to buy assets. And on the risk side, the sellers usually want to sell their equity to walk away from any risks that might kind of be hanging around.
Now, there's some insurance that can be bought to help protect against some of this.
That's right. Yeah. And that's part of the due diligence process as well. We'll usually create a report, and that report will end up going to the rep and warranty insurers, and that's what they use to form their coverage positions in terms of if a risk is identified in one of our reports, they'll say, well, you know about it as a buyer, so I'm not going to cover it as part of the insurance. You should be pricing that into your offer to the seller. But yeah, that's a big part of the process. It's really pretty new to the M&A field. It's probably in the last 10 years it became more common. Mm-hmm. It's private equity really likes it because they raise funds, capital's committed, and the idea is they return that capital in, you know, however many years, 5 years, and they don't want lingering risks to hang around. So to the extent they can, you know, manage that through rep and warranty insurance, that's really popular these days.
And really what you're learning during diligence is going to inform what the buyer is going to do for the rest of the process, right? Whether it's adjusting the purchase price because we found adjustments to EBITDA and that's going to factor into how they're valuing the company, or maybe there's a ton of tax exposures that's going to change their approach from going from a stock deal to a asset deal, right? And then how things are factored into like the purchase agreement. So what you're learning during diligence is really going to drive what happens after the completion of diligence and as you're going through and executing all of the agreements.
So, what should sellers expect? I mean, my heart goes out to these folks. I mean, they're running a company, they've got a family, they've got their personal lives, and then all of a sudden enter a process. And so what should they expect during this period of the process?
I mean, off the bat, it's going to be a lot of time and effort on their end, and we try to be mindful of that. What you don't want is for a process to take way longer than it needs to, because sellers then at that point will start to get deal fatigue and they'll just kind of be over it. But typically what we'll do is we'll put together a standard diligence request list that has a list of all the information that we're going to want from the company. And as the company provides that, we're taking that, we're processing it, we're analyzing it, and coming up with a list of questions so that we can really understand what's been going on in the company, what does performance look like. And from a financial diligence perspective, we're typically looking at the last two fiscal years plus a trailing 12-month period. Eric, for tax, you guys go back, what, 3 to 5?
We usually focus tax diligence on the statute of limitations for the relevant tax that we'd be looking at. And so for most federal and state income taxes, it's the last 3 years of tax filings. So right now we're looking at 2020, 2021, and 2022. As this year advances and 2023 filings are made, then that kind of advances forward. Some state and local taxes go back a little bit further. The only sort of additional caveat to that that sellers sometimes need to keep perspective on is if there's an issue, like, for instance, sales tax sometimes where they've never filed, there is no statute of limitations. It's unlimited. So it goes back to whenever that issue might have began. And so it can be a little bit longer, but I would say typically the last 3 years of your tax filings is what people are looking at.
So last 3 years, last 2 years, couple years.
About three, basically. We want three periods. So it's usually two fiscal years plus a trailing 12-month period. So after you give us the bulk of the information that we've asked for.
How do you exchange the information?
Pretty often, it's usually in a virtual data room. Okay. So whether it's done through your bankers, a lot of times it could be Dropbox. We kind of don't recommend sending it via email because there's a lot of parties that are going to ask for information. So you really want a virtual data room that's organized in a way that documents are really easy to find, because what you'll see is that across the different work streams, right, you might get the same request multiple times. Yep. And so you want to be able to organize it in a way where if I'm looking for something specific, I know that that's typically provided in legal diligence, I can just go to your legal diligence folder and find it.
Right.
So yeah, typically after we get a lot of the information, we'll go through, do our initial analysis, put together a list of questions, send it over to you so that you can do some research and preparation, and then we'll have what we call our management meeting. So at that point, we're going through all of our list of questions in detail. It can be pretty time consuming. It could be anywhere from a couple of hours to maybe a day or two. Mm-hmm. And after that, right, we may have some follow-up requests or follow-up questions as we're finalizing our work. But we take the information that we've learned and synthesize it in our findings and our report.
It's something that can be challenging in the process of selling a business is, one, pulling all that data together in an organized format. Two, controlling who gets it and when. There might be things in the data rooms these days. The more common was like Interlinks and Merrill. They're pretty good about, like, you can control when you add a user, what access they have. So there might be, right, you might have folders you don't let everybody see right away for whatever reason, to sort of focus their efforts and whatever. But you might
can
have
bring them into the tent, but you can kind of limit the areas that they can explore.
Right. But the other side of that that's probably really important for sellers to think about is, who do you want on your team to know that you're considering selling your company,
right?
And so, and that is a challenge a lot of times, especially when there's a lot of volume of data that people like Grace's team will be asking for, tax will be asking, legal will be asking for a lot of stuff, and kind of getting your head around who do you want to be sort of read in on the idea there could be a deal, and kind of the timing of when you want all that to take place is important to consider early.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we run into pretty frequently is, let's say the owner doesn't want it to be widespread and we don't get access to your controller or, you know, the person in charge of finance. Well, that could potentially make it much more difficult for the owner, because they're not going to know the level of details that we're going to want to know and ask about. And if they have to constantly try to get information from the controller without really telling them what it's for, you know, they're obviously going to get suspicious. But it just adds time to the diligence process. And typically, right, if we're starting diligence, you've got an LOI, you've got like an exclusivity period that you're trying to complete your work under. Right. So that, you know, potentially is something to consider.
Yeah, when we're coaching our clients, you know, we try to give them a heads up on the amount of work that's going to be happening, and kind of try to give them an understanding of like what type of things they're going to be needing to provide. And then usually 9-month process in the first couple months is like training for a marathon, right? I mean, you're getting battle tested, getting asked questions, looking for all this information, because you guys know what buyers are looking for. So you're trying to get ahead of that because you're sort of anticipating as many questions as possible and having it organized so you could quickly say, oh, yeah, no, we thought you would ask that. Here's the answer. And here are the documents to back it up.
Yeah, and I mean, using advisors can help a lot with that. In the U.S., we do a lot more buy-side diligence. It's just a lot more common for each buyer to go engage their own advisor to come in and start kind of not from scratch, but to kind of do the work themselves and prepare their own report and so forth. In Europe, it's a lot more common to do sell-side advisory work. And, you know, a report is prepared and it's provided to every buyer group. Now, those buyer groups will almost always still engage advisors, but they're not starting, you know, from zero and creating their own from scratch. They're leveraging what's there and then they're pressure testing that stuff. So that's just a cultural
thing. That's interesting. I didn't think about that.
There's aspects of the legal element of it. Like in the U.S., the accounting firms, A&M, we don't provide reliance on those type of sell side reports. It's not the legal custom. In Europe, it's the opposite, where those reports then are subject to assurances by the preparer.
To be honest, on the financial side, we're actually seeing sell-side due diligence reports become really popular, and we are seeing a lot more of those in the market. And when you think about sell-side due diligence, right, the scope of it isn't any different from what we would do on the buy side. And the advantage that it gives to sellers is that you're identifying the issues in advance, and you have the time to do, it's kind of a safe space. You have the time to do the research and have the answers so that when a buyer comes through and asks the same questions, you have a talk track prepared. Mm-hmm. If there's a big issue that comes up, it gives you time to work with your advisors and considering what's the best way to present this issue to the buyer and help them get comfortable with it in terms of how you've addressed it, what that potential impact's going to be, and so on.
So I guess your experience advising buy side mostly has got to be materially different when you are looking at a seller that's using a banker versus a family-owned company or somebody that's not does not have like representation. Because I think the bankers are in there helping them queue this stuff up, right? And having them go through a QOE, and so that when they go to market, they can. Is that what you're referencing when you're saying a sell side due diligence report?
Yep.
Like the seller has already gone through that.
The seller's already gone through that. There's typically a report that's prepared so that mm-hmm. the seller is basically saying, here's our view of what our EBITDA looks like. Here's what our QV looks like.
Right.
And that's a starting point for the buyers. And so it saves them a bit of work. It could help speed up the process and really, you know, in any transaction, speed and certainty are kind of the key elements.
So my takeaway from that is the advantages are it creates a smoother process and improves the odds of success. It helps y'all out because there's been some work done already. And then it's a function of you going in and just kind of verifying and confirming and cross-referencing with the existing documents.
Right. Yeah. You'd almost always recommend having somebody like us, an accounting firm, somebody who's helping you. Maybe it's a bank. Some banks are better at that than others, I think, just in terms of their depth of sort of expertise. But having somebody help you prepare, whether it's preparing an actual sell-side diligence report that you hand over to buyers or just running through the questions on a preliminary basis, trying to understand where there could be risk so that you start to inform yourself and your management team, where do I need to be focusing my efforts on pulling data together? Where am I going to get the most questions and interest?
So would you advise an owner to invest the time and energy and resources into going through this process before they start a process?
Yeah, and then it's just a question of the depth of what kind of help do they need? How messy are the records or the history? How many acquisitions have they done that might create complications that you can help get ahead of? The more smooth you can make the process for the buyers, right, the better for you as a seller. What you're trying to avoid in the diligence process on the sell side is adjustments to purchase price, right? Like, they're probably not going to adjust purchase price up. You know, so like you're trying to avoid, right, you know, creating any kind of extra hurdles or
yep,
you know, uncovered risks, you know, that kind of thing, right, if you can, you know, possibly avoid it.
So I was mentioning we are our team throughout the year. We will host in-person roundtable discussions. We call it our Lightning in a Bottle roundtable discussion series. And we were talking about this a couple nights ago, where the advantages of going through this process before helps mitigate potential issues down the road. Because if you don't do this, 6 months down the road, you're really engaged with the potential with a buyer. And as they said, you're already pregnant at 6 months down the road. And then they come back and they're like, oh, hey, we found this or that, and we need to adjust the transaction price. And you've got deal fatigue, and then everybody gets worn down. It bums you out. And so the emotional and mental part of going through a process is such a big deal. In fact, that was one of our guests suggested that we bring somebody on to help with the mental aspects of dealing with failure, dealing with challenges, like just the stuff that it takes to run, to build, grow, and sell a company.
Well, and I think too, by kind of doing sell side process, you're kind of doing a dry run of what the buy side process is going to be, yep, right? Because in theory, as advisors, we're not doing anything different on the sell side that we would do on the buy side. Now, practically, obviously, our client's different and sure, the motivations are a little bit different, but actually, we're doing the same kind of procedures. And where it can really help you is when you do identify those like weak points or just areas of every business is going to experience this risk, like sales tax, for instance. Like, a lot of businesses struggle with that. You probably heard of the Wayfair case, Supreme Court case that came out several years ago now, but it's, you know, taken a while to kind of run through all the different states and changing their tax laws. But the way that you tax sales changed pretty dramatically so that it's, you can be subject to tax in a lot of different states, even though you might not have people there and so forth. Mm-hmm. And by doing a sell side process, you can identify something like that and start to mitigate or fix that problem before you have buyers asking the questions and then them trying to on the fly mm-hmm. make their own conservative estimates of how bad the issue might be and then trying to adjust your purchase price based on mm-hmm. a quick analysis rather than you've taken the time to do a little bit more thorough and present it to them like, we know it exists, we're fixing it, yeah, here's, it's not that bad.
How far in advance of starting a process do you think somebody should go through this? Or should they do it just as a matter of hygiene? Like, should you go through this once every couple of years just to kind of tighten it up? Or is it something you just want to really do right before process?
I think the more likely it is you think somebody's going to want to invest in your business, the more you should be considering it. And if you think somebody is going to want to...
You need some time to iron out some problems that you discover, right?
Right. And I think 6 months, 3 months is a pretty quick turnaround to be able to do it and really be ready. I mean, if you find issues, it's going to take you a few months to even get your head around how to correct them. Okay. So 6 months would be, I think, a pretty good rule of thumb. I mean, a year would probably be better, especially if you actually think there are problems you need to correct. It's going to take you some time to do it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And prove that it's been taken care of.
On the flip side of that, though, right, if you start this too early, by the time you actually go to market, like if I'm covering the last 12 months through, let's say, January, and you go to market in September, that LTM January just isn't going to be as applicable anymore. Right. And they're going to want that go forward.
So there's a little bit of an art in terms of the timing, because 6 months could be material changes. Market could change. We could have a pandemic that shuts the world down. I mean, you know, things happen.
Exactly. Oh, no, I was going to say, on the flip side, if you do start it early, you do get ahead of some of the issues. You have time to correct it. And then as you do a roll forward, it becomes a quicker process. Right. So it's not as though you're starting from the very beginning. It's quicker to do a roll forward than it is to do an analysis from the very beginning.
I'm going to combine these two questions here, talking about the most tax efficient transaction structure and also the types of tax risks and exposures that are most common. You mentioned the sales tax issue, but as far as tax efficiency, taxes, we talk about taxes all the time. That's the number one biggest cost to investors, to us all, right? And I was reading an article last night on Bloomberg about our deficit, and it's being suggested that taxes start to move higher to help start to shrink this deficit problem that we've got in this country. So it's only going, it feels like it's only going to get worse, right? I mean, taxes are not worse. Well, worse, yes, but more important to be extremely mindful of taxes. So maybe you guys can speak a little bit on that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll kind of go first on that one. I mean, there's no doubt that it's more likely that rates go up than come down materially from where they are. I mean, they're relatively low in the grand scheme of things at the moment. That being said, it's important to remember in sort of the tax world that there's a concept of double tax. If you have a corporation, the corporation pays tax, and then the owner of that entity pays tax again when they receive a distribution from it, just conceptually. Like there are all kinds of different sort of hybrid scenarios, like an S-corp that's a corp, but it doesn't pay tax at the corporate level. It only pays at the shareholder level. And then there's also partnerships where there's only one layer of tax. The partnership doesn't pay tax. It's not a taxable entity per se. It files a tax return, but it doesn't pay anything. And then the partners pay tax. In terms of efficiency, staying in that flow-through partnership structure is always better if you can. But there's all kinds of legal reasons why you need to be a corp sometimes, and you are already organized that way, and
well,
so qualified
forth. Qualified small business
is
important part of that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so then there's all kinds of extra other tools that help balance that, particularly to your point around like small businesses. So there's qualified small business stock that can be a helpful tool. I mean, that allows some exclusion of the seller's gain if all the qualifications are met. There's opportunity zone investing where if you meet the qualifications of creating a capital gain that you can then defer if you invested in what's determined an opportunity zone, which is an IRS treasury determination of sort of low income or incentivized economic areas. And they're all over the country. You know, there's other elements of your transaction structure that can help mitigate the tax cost, including rolling over equity, which is really common when you're getting new investors, right? They want to make sure the founders stay, you know, have some skin in the game, usually making sure that equity that you keep, whether it's the same equity you've always held or it's equity in a new entity that's a combined acquirer entity, that it is tax deferred so that you're rolling over, not paying tax on that. If you can, you can use installment sales to defer the recognition of some of your income and by when you actually receive, you know, sort of cash. So there's all kinds of ways that you can sort of manage when and how you get taxed. But like going back to the most tax efficient manner is to always be in a flow through format, including today and as you take on new investors or as you sell, that you're selling into structures that are similar. But there are a million reasons why that doesn't always work out. And then you go into these sort of other considerations like the qualified small business stock or rollover equity or, you know, like-kind exchanges come up sometimes as, you know, transfers of assets. But there's no one size fits all.
Is there an analysis that could be done if an owner wants to get a more clear understanding of their actual tax implications of the transaction and what it means to them personally?
Yes.
How? Yeah.
How,
so, I mean,
where would they start? How would they? What questions would they ask? Who would they talk to?
So, you know, when clients come to me and want to understand what's the best, I want to sell my business, what's the best way to do it? The first step is we want to understand the structure of the existing company and what is, one, what do we think buyers, who are the buyers going to be? Right. Corporate strategics, private equities, other small business owners. And then we try to understand, okay, well, if you were to sell assets because the buyer prefers to buy only the assets, or you're trying to carve out a part of your business, you're going to keep some of it and you're only trying to sell something, you know, a piece of it, what would be the cost of doing that? And that includes mirroring it with your existing structure. So if you have an existing corporate structure, that means you're going to pay that double tax potentially. So starting to think about how would that sort of flow through the system? And are you trying to get cash out, or are you going to use that cash within this business to go and reinvest it in something else? So it would be a combination of thinking about what would an asset sale look like, and then separately, what would a stock sale look like? And that takes into account frequently some of your own personal income tax profile characteristics, like what other businesses do you have? Do you have any losses that might offset this sale? What tax rate are you in? What states are you in? And frequently selling assets within a business is taxed differently from a state perspective than selling the stock of your business. But you're really balancing. We're always looking for, obviously, the lowest cash tax to be paid, but cap gains usually are subject to lower tax. And there's maybe a little bit, frequently it's easier to manage on the state side when it's just a cap gain and just selling shares, rather than when you're selling assets across a business, you're having to think about a lot of different state implications, and then you're having to filter that all the way up kind of through your structure back to you and your own personal 1120 filing.
On the financial side, what are some things that, I'm sure you got some stories of things that you've come across.
Is there any? I don't think we have time for all of that, Josh.
What's the first one that comes to mind, like something kind of crazy? Is there anything that's been a little bit wild that you've seen?
I mean, you know, we've seen a lot of businesses that are just so closely held. There's a lot of commingling between owner's personal expenses, owner's business expenses. Maybe the owner has multiple businesses set up and they're selling from one company to another, and you have costs that they say these are the costs of the products that I'm producing, but it's coming from this other entity that they own that isn't part of the transaction structure. So as you learn this information, the scope of your diligence is going to change so that you're addressing these risks. So that's my latest example.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of see everything. I mean, it's definitely the commingling of businesses and also personal assets can be a complication that whether you're on the buy or the sell side, it just takes you time to get your arms around it. And well, you're always, you know, right, you're trying to get back to the quality of earnings concept of like what's normalized earnings for this business. And so in some cases, it's a little bit more challenging to figure out what that real true economic normalized earnings are if there are a lot of assets that are in the mix that aren't part of the transaction perimeter, right?
And as a seller, we just ask you to be honest, right? We're not judging you. You can run your business however you want to see fit. But for us to do our job appropriately, we just need that level of honesty so that we can get to what that normalized view of EBITDA is.
Right.
And honestly, we've probably, whatever it is you're doing, we've probably seen it before. And we're not judging you on it by any stretch of the imagination. We just need to know.
Well, that's a conversation that we have oftentimes when we are preparing for a potential exit, is understanding how much of their lifestyle is a result of the business, the cash flows that are generated from the business. So they might be paying themselves $1 million a year, but when you go in and you recast those numbers, you're like, we don't need to pay a CEO $1 million a year. We can find somebody to do this for $300,000 a year. So that's $700,000 that gets put back in. And then conversely, you get some folks that only pay themselves $1 because they want to, maybe they're a little bit more altruistic or whatever, you know, whatever it might be, but they don't realize how that negatively impacts the numbers because we've got to pay somebody to run this place, right? So that's something that gets pulled off.
And from a valuation perspective, that $700,000 isn't $700,000.
Exactly.
$700,000 times a multiple.
That's right.
And then it becomes real dollars that you want you want credit for.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And it, on the other side, it's like that can, the $300,000, there's a 10 multiple on it, it's a real number. It's a real number. And then alternatively, like, we want to prepare these people for life afterwards. So if they're not able to run a lot of this stuff, you know, through the company now, like, we have to figure out whether or not their after tax number is sufficient enough to maintain the lifestyle that they've become accustomed to having, right? And so that's a critical piece of the puzzle. Okay, so we're, you know, getting towards the end of our session here. I guess let's talk about, we talked about tax exposures and how they can impact the purchase price. We talked about some of the financials and how that can impact the purchase price. How are those, like, addressed in the purchase agreements? First of all, what's a purchase agreement? Maybe we should cover that one.
So, yeah, I mean, the purchase agreement, they're standardized in concept, right? Like, they're pretty similarly laid out, each of them. But it'll start with, is it an asset purchase agreement or is it a stock purchase agreement? And the recitals will lay out, like, the sort of overarching qualifications of who is the buyer, who is the seller, and what are they selling? Are they selling shares of an entity? Are they selling assets? And then it'll go through definitions of what do we consider to be net working capital and cash, and consideration is X dollars of enterprise value plus or minus all these adjusting items like targeted net working capital and debt-like items. And debt-like items will then include all the things we've uncovered in diligence that might be non-normalized business issues that aren't already on sort of like the balance sheet, or maybe are on the balance sheet but are not part of net working capital. And so that in particular becomes one that reduces for the cash consideration component. So obviously we don't, nobody likes to see those if they can be avoided. But then beyond that, you'll go into, there'll be a section on the representations and warranties of the seller. And so, for instance, on the tax side, it'll be that I've filed all my tax returns, that I have no known, you know, issues. I'm not open to an examination right now.
On the financial side, it could be, hey, all of my accounts receivables are in normal course. I think that they're all collectible. If they're not, I've established a reserve. I think all of my inventory is in good saleable condition. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of things.
Frequently define, like, what's GAAP. Are the financial statements on a GAAP basis, or are they on some kind of modified GAAP basis? And what does that mean? What are we agreeing that means here? And then there'll be sort of a section of addressing in sort of this interim period of, you'll have a closing date and there'll be a period before closing and a period after closing, like, who's responsible for whether it be tax issues or the accounting issues that come up in those periods, and how do you define sort of the straddle period and how you share economic responsibilities.
Yep. After close, how are you going to true up the purchase price to reflect what was actually delivered at closing? Mm-hmm. All of that's going to be guided by what's in that purchase agreement. So it's really critical for the purchase agreement to reflect everything that you've learned during diligence. And it's not just a template that gets filled out. It gets tailored. It gets modified to reflect all of the facts and circumstances that you've learned about this company so that you're getting adequate protection as the buyer. And conversely, as the seller, you want to make sure that you're protected as well.
And then finally, there will be a section that addresses indemnity, right? So who's responsible for issues that come up after closing that relate to pre-closing periods? And that's where, if there are issues, maybe there is an escrow related specifically to certain issues. Maybe it is broad and it says, I'm just going to hold back $1 million for a year just to make sure there aren't any issues that I need to seek an indemnity for. And then there's also the concept of rep and warranty insurance, which will frequently be addressed in that indemnity section to say that we're agreeing that you're going to go seek a policy to cover indemnity. And it'll be based on the representations that we're making here. And then that insurer is essentially taking the economic responsibility for that indemnity.
Well, I was going to ask this last question, but I feel like we've done a pretty good job on this, which was, you know, what could a seller do to prepare for diligence and avoid purchase price adjustments? And I think we've covered a lot of that stuff. I mean, I think the big takeaway that I've got after this conversation is I'm going to pound the table even more to clients, like, hey, this is so important. You know, this is going to prevent a lot of heartache and probably some tears down the road.
Yeah, and you really need to think of it as an investment, right? You're investing your time and energy on the front end so that you can ensure a smooth transaction. You're making sure that the expectations of the buyers are going to be met and your expectations aren't going to be set inappropriately. And I would say the other thing to think about is really don't put your time and effort into diligence at the expense of your normal operations of the business, right? You've probably spent years or decades building a successful business, and you still need to run that business. You don't get to just drop everything because, hey, I have a potential, you know, liquidity event coming up. You still have to operate and grow that business so that you're really delivering the business that you've built.
I think that also speaks to the importance of having a good team wrapped around you. You can't do this all by yourself. And having a good team that has been there and done that several times is, I mean, this is, we tell people this is going to be the largest, this will most likely be the largest financial event of your life. And you only get one shot to do this and do it right. And so one of my colleagues had talked about, I think she had been told one time, in the past, don't ask directions to somebody that's never been there before. And I thought that was a good visual for me. So any parting thoughts before we wrap it up here?
I think being honest kind of with yourself and balanced in recognizing how close you are to a transaction. And I think most folks understand how well their business is currently kind of being run and taken care of. The pressure points, and some are pressure points that every business has, yeah. And that's okay. And some are unique to your business, and being honest with yourself on where the risks fall, which bucket, mm-hmm. and the ones that are unique to your business, trying to get ahead of them, either making changes or just being ready for the questions that are going to come.
And I also think with M&A, there's so many nuances to it that you want to make sure you're finding your right team of trusted advisors who have experience. You may have a corporate lawyer or a personal CPA who's helping you, but if they're not well-versed or familiar with what happens in an M&A process, they're not going to be able to give you the advice or know what's going on in the deal right. cycle to be able to give you like the right advice. So I do think that, you know, you should spend time in figuring out who your team is, both internally and externally, right?
Right. Well, I think that's a wrap. Thank you so much. It's a privilege to have both Eric and Grace with us here today, and you've been very generous with your time this morning. And Eric, thank you for taking the time to drive down from Dallas.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And so anyway, with that, I'll let everybody get back to their days. And for those of you that are still with us, thank you for sticking with us to the end here. So thank you. Take care. Be well.
Thanks, Josh.
On behalf of our entire team here at ATX Wealth Partners, we hope you enjoyed this program. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email us at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And remember this, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Until next time, take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.